This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year. I don't know if there'll be snow, but have a cup of cheer.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Obviously, we're winding down 2023. It should be a festive time. It should be a joyous time. But unfortunately, there are a lot of different corners of the world that are experiencing strife and war, devastation, people losing their homes, and overall destruction. And a lot of us have been looking for answers. One of the people that I have looked to for years for answers when it comes to foreign policy is Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Now, I've been known for giving flowery introductions of people, sometimes I've been accused of hyperbole, exaggerating someone's claims. When it comes to Jeffrey Sachs, the only thing I'm going to do is read a small portion of his resume just so that you understand the magnitude and the gravitas of his credentials. And you can see why people like me look to him for expertise when it comes to foreign policy. He is a university professor and the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia, where he directed the Earth Institute for about 14 years. He's also the president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network and a commissioner of the UN Broadband Commission for Development. He's been an advisor to three UN secretaries general and currently serves as an SDG advocate under the current secretary general. He's an author, most recently, of A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism. Professor Jeffrey Sachs, I'm a big fan. It's great to talk to you.
Hey, Frank, thank you so much. Very nice. Thanks a lot.
Let me begin by asking about Abu Dhabi. I know you were out there in advance of COP28. You gave an address that a lot of religious leaders and world leaders are still talking about it. I'm curious if you could just tell us a little bit about your experience there and what you think the key takeaways of COP28 were. Do you think this has been effective?
Well, you know, 2023 will be the hottest year in history, maybe the hottest year for tens of thousands of years on the planet. So we're in the midst of a very serious climate crisis, but all of our attention is diverted by these terrible wars that you talked about. So before the meeting on climate, which was in Dubai, there was a meeting of religious leaders from all different faiths, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that came together in Abu Dhabi. And I had a chance to speak with them and speak to them. And I didn't say anything very original. I said, if we don't settle these wars, we're never going to even turn our attention to the climate crisis. And I believe these wars could end very quickly because they're driven by politics. So if we focused not on hating each other and killing each other, but actually on the underlying politics, we could end the wars. And it's a point that I also made when I was invited to speak to the United Nations Security Council about 4 weeks ago. I was invited as a kind of witness to the 15 governments that are on the council, and I gave them a piece of my mind, which is that they are responsible for ending these wars. That's actually their mandate under the United Nations rules, and they're not doing their job. Of course, they're bickering with each other. The United States is busy vetoing what all the rest of the world wants, and we're not getting anywhere.
Let me begin with the Ukraine situation, because I think since October 7th, a lot of the Western media has shifted its focus away from Ukraine and towards the Middle East. But that doesn't make the situation in Eastern Europe any less significant or any less tragic. For starters, one of the things that I've had a very tough time getting a proper accounting of is what the casualty numbers are. Do we have any idea of what the casualties are on either the Ukrainian side or the Russian side as a result of this conflict?
Numbers are flying around, but a recent number on the Ukrainian dead and wounded is about 400,000. And that is probably on the low side, but it shows the magnitude of the catastrophic loss that's underway. And of that 400,000, again, which I would say is a minimum, the way that it's counted, there have been probably up to 200,000 dead and seriously wounded. That is not lightly wounded, but seriously wounded and disabled during the months of the so-called counteroffensive, which started this June and basically, has stopped as of about a month ago. But this was a catastrophic year for Ukraine, predictably so, according to the kind of experts that I follow about the battlefield. According to Western media, it was a big surprise how bad it was. But if you were following closely, it was not a surprise at all. Russia is trouncing Ukraine. And not surprisingly, it's a much, much bigger country, a very sophisticated country, a very sophisticated military, very different from what we're told all the time about the bumbling failures and Russia's about to collapse. That's been spin, unfortunately, on the U.S. side, and almost everything that our government has done has been based not on real calculation or understanding, but on wishful thinking. The result of all of this is that rather than having negotiated a peace arrangement, which was possible many times in recent years, the United States kept telling the Ukrainians, go out and fight. We got your back. And they have been slaughtered.
I mean, to me, that's just a horrible, horrible situation and the very definition of a tragedy. Now, when you say all of this was foreseeable, meaning the casualty numbers, the nature of how the conflict has gone between Russia and Ukraine, the United States assistance to Ukraine prolonging rather than helping bring an end to this conflict, given the prism of hindsight, and again, based on your view and others, it sounds like, hindsight wasn't needed. It sounded like you have the foresight for this back 2 years ago. What should the response to the United States have been once Russia made the decision to invade Ukraine?
What is not really ever explained by our government to the American people is that the United States started a kind of gambit, a strategic play in 2008 to expand our military bases into Ukraine. And the Russians said, no, don't do that. And the United States said, oh, come on, we're peace-loving, don't worry about it. And the Russians said, really, don't do that. Do not come closer. Stay away. Ukraine should be neutral. And the United States said, nah, come on, they can do what they want, as if we would just not care if, say, China started setting up military bases on the Rio Grande border with the United States and Mexico. In other words, we absolutely don't want to even try to think of things through the eyes of the other guy. But the Russians kept saying, don't do that. And then in 2014, when Ukraine had a president that was very delicately and with some agility, actually balancing between the U.S. pressures and the Russian pressures by saying that Ukraine should be neutral. Thank you very much. We're kind of in the middle of you two big guys. The United States conspired to overthrow this guy. You'll recall our then Assistant Secretary of State out on the Maidan, which is the big square in Kiev, handing out cookies. In the meantime, our intelligence services and so forth were doing more than handing out cookies. We were actively engaged in the overthrow of a neutral government, which, by the way, unfortunately, is how American foreign policy works normally. That's not even exceptional foreign policy. That is what the CIA and others do for a living. They overthrow other governments. And you shouldn't do it next door to Russia. That's the main point. The Russians see everything, know everything. They actually intercepted one of the planning calls of Victoria Nuland with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, Jeffrey Piat, who also is now a senior official in the State Department. And they were conspiring online about who's going to be in which positions. And the Russians intercepted it. They posted it online. We got all to hear this. And then it happened just the way that this phone call said it would. The U.S. pick for prime minister became the new prime minister after the overthrow of the president. The American people aren't told any of this right. background. So this war started actually 9 years ago in 2014. You wouldn't know it by any of the reporting, because according to the official narrative, it started February 24th, 2022, which is just not true, actually. It started 9 years ago, and there was a lot of fighting, a lot of deaths, but it kept escalating. And the Russians kept saying, we need to stop this. We need to negotiate together. And the United States kept saying, it's none of your business. We're going to expand NATO, and you have no say in it. The Russians tried on December 15th, 2021, a last attempt to negotiate. I was following it very closely. I called the White House. I said, it's really a good idea to negotiate, avoid this war. Who the hell needs another war on this planet? And the White House counterpart that I spoke with, very senior, said, no, nothing to negotiate. And war started immediately after. I shouldn't say the war started. I should say Russia's escalation on February 24th, 2022 occurred, because the war really had been going on for years with a lot of deaths and a lot of violence. But it escalated with Russia moving in about 40,000 troops. And immediately the Ukrainians said, okay, we'll negotiate neutrality with you. And the Turks, very helpfully, the next door neighbors to both of them in the Black Sea, said, we'll mediate. And so a negotiation process started in Ankara, the capital of Turkey. And I flew to Ankara because I was really curious. I spoke with the mediators at length and learned the details. And at some point, as this was nearing a real agreement, the United States stepped in and said, we don't accept you, Ukraine, accepting neutrality. You have to keep fighting, and we've got your back, and we've got all sorts of weapons for you. We're going to send HIMARS for you. We're going to give you all sorts of armaments. Just keep fighting. And our Secretary of Defense, so-called, it's a misnomer, it's our Secretary of War, Lloyd Austin, publicly said, our goal, our aim is to weaken Russia, not to secure Ukraine, but to weaken Russia. We wanted the Ukrainians to keep fighting. Now, I follow the events hour by hour, day by day, and the military experts knew that Ukraine was outgunned, outclassed, manpower, huge disadvantage. And while Ukraine could make some tactical victories in a war of attrition, this was going to be a disaster. And our more intelligent parts of our government, like the RAND Corporation, which is an analytical, not a political unit, said, you know, a long war is definitely to our disadvantage. But we're led by politicians, not by professionals. And these politicians are really incompetent, actually. And they just kept sending Ukraine to the battlefront. And now the situation is awful. The Ukrainians are being beaten back all along the contact line in many, many parts of the contact line. Every day, new losses. Every day, hundreds of Ukrainians dead. Ukraine has run out of trained soldiers, so they're rounding up people violently, basically off the streets, young people, giving them a couple of weeks training, and they're sent to the front line to die. And we're encouraging more of that because all this is, at this point, quite embarrassing to Biden. And he's got an election campaign coming up, and the last thing in the world he wants is for the truth to start to come out. And so they're encouraging the Ukrainians, keep fighting. We're going to get you something. We're going to get you more weapons. We're going to get you the money. And every professional knows this is a disaster and a bloodbath. And what's really needed is actual, real discussion between the United States and Russia, especially over real security issues. Mm-hmm. Don't put military bases of the United States inside Ukraine. Russia's got to go home. The United States has to stop pushing this NATO enlargement. And it isn't hindsight. This has been the issue since 2008, when the United States under George W. Bush Jr., but with incredibly, by the way, his NATO ambassador was Victoria Nuland, who's the one that passed out cookies in 2014 and is now the undersecretary of state under Biden. She's just there.
No, it's incredible.
It is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Democrat, Republican, every administration except Trump manages to find a key policy place for Victoria Nuland.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Professor Jeffrey Sachs. He's the author of many books, including A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism. I want to touch on the Middle East situation, but just to sum up the Ukraine war, I think Americans, whether they're left wing, right wing, or non-political, they tend to see themselves as the good guys. And I think you've explained why the narrative that a lot of Americans bought into 2 years ago, that we're just helping a country that was invaded by a hostile neighbor, I think you've explained why that's a flawed way of looking at this. I think you've also explained why whatever quote-unquote assistance that we've given to the Ukrainians really hasn't helped them. It's actually hurt them. I think it's also very telling, the quote from Secretary Lloyd Austin, that this is primarily about weakening Russia right now. Now, let's say that is the foreign policy goal du jour. And again, initially we were told we were doing this to liberate the Ukrainians. Now we're being told this is being done to weaken Russia. And even Bill Kristol, in the ads that his group is putting out there, they're saying that this is the goal of all this Ukrainian aid. If that is a rationale that people are for, is it working and has it worked? Is Russia at all weakened by the United States intervention in this Ukraine conflict?
Russia is considerably stronger today than it was before this conflict, because the military has been upgraded considerably, and one can actually watch in real time the technology generational improvement. By that, I mean the turnover, for example, of the drones, of the smart weaponry, of their range, of their sophistication, of their mass production, of the electronic warfare. Russia is substantially stronger today than it was 2 years ago. And Ukraine has run through several armies by now, hundreds and hundreds of thousands lost, whatever the precise number is. The population has declined well over 10 million because of all the people that have fled the country. And by some counts, 20 million. It's, again, large uncertainties. But Russia has not been weakened. The United States has drawn down its inventories. That's one of the real facts, which the U.S. government acknowledged, is we ran out of 155 millimeter shells. We ran out of shells to give to Ukraine. So everything is wrong with it. By the way, it's even crazier than saying that it's to weaken Russia. There are real grown-ups in the government and in the Congress that really believe this is all to show our strength vis-a-vis China. It's nuts, I have to say, this whole concept that this is anything about proving our mettle vis-a-vis China. China's looking on and watching, first of all, Russia be victorious, improve the technologies, the sanctions absolutely boomerang, the United States increasingly isolated diplomatically, the U.S. arsenals and inventories basically drawn down, not to mention now what's happening in the Middle East. If this is to be tough to China, my God, we better get a new team. This is so ridiculous. It bears no sense at all. It's also disgustingly cynical because you shouldn't really use another country in that way and have it destroyed so that we can prove how tough we are. For me, it harks back to my childhood. We used to have the domino theory. That's why we were going to bomb Vietnam to smithereens and next door Cambodia and Laos. That's how I spent my childhood, listening to such ridiculous, pernicious theories that you do something in one country so you look tough in another country. And that's actually what grown-ups say in Washington. Our senators, Blumenthal in Connecticut, shocking stuff, actually. Yeah, Mitt Romney, shocking stuff. They're not even coy about it. They're just saying this is great money. It's weakening Russia, showing how tough we are to China, and we're not losing a life in the United States. This is the kind of rhetoric that they've used. Right. It's all terribly, terribly wrong.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, Professor Sachs, I'd love to do a full hour, maybe even 2 hours with you one day in discussing foreign policy. Unfortunately, I realize it's late and neither of us have the time to do that today, but I can't let the opportunity to speak with you go by without asking you about the situation in the Middle East. The UN is now reporting that more than 570,000 people in Gaza are now starving due to fallout from the war. We've seen tens of thousands of Palestinians killed, the large number of them civilians, people that are very supportive of the Israeli handling of this. They'll say that's terrible. It's tragic. But the tragedy is all born because of the actions of Hamas. They're responsible for these people starving and for all the civilian casualties. I know you've been quite critical of Israel's handling of this war since October 7th. Once October 7th occurred, and once we saw these Hamas terrorists kill all these Israelis, including Israeli civilians, capture others and kidnap them, what should the response from Israel have been? What would have been the proper way, in your view, to handle it after October 7th?
The Arab states immediately met. In fact, there was an Arab Islamic summit in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia, where all the neighboring states and Iran, by the way, together said, we will secure Israel and Palestine and work to make sure that there is safety and peace. But there has to be a follow-up to 56 years of a promise of a Palestinian state. This is a position I completely subscribe to. You can't look at this as starting in October 7, because on October 6, Gaza was at a boil. And years and years leading up to October 7, all independent observers knew that the situation was explosive. The United States, again, was faking it. In fact, faking it or so incompetent, and it's hard to tell the difference sometimes. But Jake Sullivan, our national security advisor, actually said 2 weeks before October 7 that the Middle East is quieter than it has been in 20 years, and the crisis in Gaza is basically resolved. Now, such absurdity shows either a detachment from reality or an inability to look at basic facts or an unwillingness to look at basic facts. The point I'm making is that, like all conflicts, this has a political root. The political root is that Israel and Palestine need both to have security and to live side by side. That was the judgment of the international community in the immediate aftermath of the 1967 war in Resolution 242 of the UN Security Council. It was followed after 1973 by UN Security Council Resolution 338, and since then by dozens of Security Council and General Assembly resolutions saying the two nations need to live side by side in peace on the 1967 borders. And since 2002, the Arab League, that is the countries in the Arab region, have said very explicitly that they want peace and normalization with Israel based on the international law, based on two states. Now, the Israelis have rejected that. Netanyahu, who has been in power basically since 2009 with the short breaks, is dead set against it. And this is not a surmise. That's the party platform of Likud. And the platform of not only Netanyahu, but even more extreme positions of the rest of his cabinet is that there should be one country, Greater Israel, extending from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. And for a number of the members of the cabinet, that's because, in their view, God gave them the land in the book of Joshua, in the Bible, and that's just the way it's going to be. Now, we will never have peace on that basis. And the finance minister, Smotrich, who calls himself a fascist, by the way, it's not putting words in his mouth. He jokes about it. Smotrich, the Interior Minister Ben-Gvir, the Defense Minister Gallant, the Prime Minister Netanyahu are dead set against any politics. So they say the only thing we can do is destroy Hamas, which basically is tantamount to mass ethnic cleansing. And according to some legal specialists, such as the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York, tantamount to genocide, both the intent and action. The United States is every day providing the bombs for this. 20,000 people minimum have been killed, because that's the body count, not all the people under the rubble. 70% of those killed are women and children. It's a massacre. It is an outright, out and out massacre. It is massive war crimes, and it's all done to avoid any negotiation and any talk of politics. It's done in the name of so-called greater Israel. And that is an ideology. That is a religious view for these religious nationalists, which is a category of Judaism in Israel, of extreme right-wing nationalists. It's not a category of the religion per se, but of a group that happens to have a lot of the cabinet in the current government. So the fact of the matter is, we are abetting a view that is absolutely a literal dead end and a metaphorical dead end to any kind of peace other than slaughter. The United States knows it. American politicians are trained never to say anything bad about Israel. What Israel's doing is massive war crimes. It is despicable, and it's in the vision of something that is impossible in terms of any kind of peace in that region. It's deadly. It's against international law. The Americans know it. And, of course, Biden is just really a pathetic – I mean, he's pathetic, actually, and he's pathetically weak president, and his team is pathetically weak. They don't know what to do, except they keep giving the bombs every day. That's it.
I'll end with this, sir. A lot of people that are supportive of Israel, they also view Israel very much as the good guys in all of these conflicts, the victim based on what happened on October 7th. And when they wage war, people tell the story of Israel waging war very ethically, not only providing warnings, not only leafleting, not only using dummy bombs, but actually when they need to do something like invade or take over a hospital, they'll bring incubators for the people in that hospital, which is something that the defenders of Israel will point out is not something that's typically done by hostile armies. Two-part question, and I realize we're way long, so I'll make this my final question here. One, what is Israel doing that's exactly a war crime, and what is the fallacy in the notion that Israel is waging an ethical war? And then lastly, if you could tie this into that answer, is Israel safer today than they were on October 6th?
Yeah, and you know, I'd like to say, just if people don't know me and they may think I'm an Israel hater or something, I've been going to Israel for more than 50 years. I have family in Israel. I am not an Israel hater. I am so sad and upset by this, I can't even tell you. This is a tragedy, and it is a self-destruction of Israel. This is not bringing any security at all to Israel. This is absolutely threatening Israel fundamentally, because the entire world is standing against Israel, because Israel is slaughtering innocent people every day. And the only backer that Israel has is the United States. And in the United States, much of the public is aghast at what we're doing, as I am, absolutely aghast young people are completely shocked by this. So Israel is losing even its last defender because it's doing the undefensible. It is just killing people in extraordinary numbers, innocent people. Let me say, without getting into all of the specifics, in my opinion, Israel's doing nothing to protect civilians. It is using dumb bombs. It is deliberately blowing up apartment buildings. It is blowing up hospitals. It is blowing up schools. It has weaponized food, and there are hundreds of thousands of people that are profoundly, profoundly hungry, and I don't know if starving is right, but that's a term that is being used by UN officials right now. I do not accept that Israel's taking any precautions. Israel is using mass force to ethnically cleanse this region. That was their plan. The plan was, we're going to scare everybody so that they flee to the south and force Egypt to accept these people. That is the plan. And the plan didn't work because Egypt said no. And the United States buckled on it also because the United States didn't want to be so visibly a party to ethnic cleansing. But I haven't heard one credible military expert from outside Israel, and I don't find the IDF spokespeople credible at all, but any independent outside expert say anything other than what Israel is doing is destroying a civilian population. And it's before our eyes. Even American officials like Lloyd Austin mumble this. Of course, this is the terrible fact of American politics. There's no truth in anything our government officials say about anything anymore. They just don't even have the idea of telling the truth as a basic standard of daily life. So it's not specific to this. They lie about every single thing that is in front of them because everything is spin now.
Professor Sachs, it's okay. I wish we had more time, and I do hope you'll come back and we can continue.
There's not a shred of evidence that they're taking care. They've killed 20,000 people, and the vast majority of them are women and children. So where's the care there? There isn't.
I do hope we can chat again in the future. We've been talking with Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, the director of the Center for Sustainable Development, also the author of A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a nice Christmas and a great holiday season.
You too.
If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you could give me a call, 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Other Side of Midnight.